Call the meeting, this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Time is 1 p.m. on Wednesday, February 9th, 2011. Let the record reflect, members present include Representative Kawasaki, Representative Dick, Representative Herron, Representative Gardner, Representative Munoz, co-chair Seaton, and myself, co-chair Feige. Representative Foster will be a little late. He is excused until then. Also like to acknowledge in the audience we have Representative Costello and Representative Hawker. All right. I'd like to welcome everybody back to yet another action-packed day in the committee. Today we will hear from Roger Marks. Roger is a consultant to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And his presentation today is on the history of Alaska's oil and gas production severance tax. We have asked for this presentation as part of the educational process as we move forward with our deliberations on House Bill 110. And before I let Mr. Marks begin his presentation, for those of you who don't know, he is probably one of the most qualified individuals to give this presentation, as his career has spanned the entire history of oil taxation in Alaska. So with that, Mr. Marks, if you would welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Marks. I'm with Logson Associates and under contract to LBNA. And as you said, here today present a history of the severance tax. Just very brief background about myself. Before entering private practice about 2 years ago, I was a petroleum economist with the Tax Division, Department of Revenue, between 1983 and 2008, about 25 years. Spent a lot of that time analyzing the production tax and had some involvement in many of the events I'm going to talk about today. And just two caveats before we begin. Now, some of these events I'm going to talk about, some of the details, there's really no written record. And what I'm going to describe today reflects a combination of my recollections and a lot of conversations I've had with a lot of people over the years. It's certainly possible that other people could have different recollections of those events. And also, insofar as this is a history, there's some interpretation and judgment involved, and certainly other reasonable people could have different interpretations than what I'm going to lay out today. So please feel free to ask questions as we go along. To begin, just sort of to set the flavor of events as they happened over the last 34 years, we're going to concentrate on the North Slope. This is actually information that that Department of Revenue put up the other day as well. Just sort of the two major forces that flavored all these events were production and price. And this shows ANS production over the last 34 years. ANS means Alaska North Slope crude oil. Anything that goes through TAPS is called ANS. And it started in 1977. It peaked in about 1988 at about 2 million barrels a day and has been going downhill ever since. Cook Inlet, which has also been an important part of Alaska oil and gas history, started up in 1958 with Swanson River, peaked in 1970 at about 200,000 barrels. Now it's down to just 10,000 barrels a day. Gas in Cook Inlet, it peaked at about 2 billion cubic feet a day of production during the 90s. And since then, it's about three-fourths of that level. Here's the price side of things. Because of the scaling, These little bumps that happened, between 1977 and 1997 don't look like much, but back then a difference of $5 a barrel made a huge was a big deal in terms of state revenues, and some of the more notable events: 1979 Iraqi Revolution, oil's price crash in 1986. Prices went down to about $6 a barrel for a while when OPEC decided to flood the market to try to enforce the market discipline. You see the first Gulf War in 1990. And ever since 1998, prices have been climbing due to a combination of increased world demand and the end of the era of cheap oil. Every new barrel of oil you produce now is cost more expensive to produce, which has made costs go up. And if we just sort of toggle back and forth between these last two graphs, you can see that with the decline of Alaska production, we've been very fortunate that price has gone up to offset that production decline. So what is the production tax? It's also called the severance tax. It's a tax on producing or severing a non-renewable resource from the state. It's authorized in AS 4355 and administered by the Department of Revenue. It applies to all production in the state or on state land, including state land that goes to 3 miles offshore, and also includes federal onshore acreage. So if we had production from MPRA, or if ANWR were opened up and we had production for there, that production would be subject to the state severance tax as well. The tax is not payable on the public, state and federal royalty production. So most state leases have a royalty of about an eighth, so the production tax is only payable on the 7/8 that's non-royalty.
And we'll let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Wilson.
Now, the production tax or severance tax is only one element of a few other elements of state revenue that we get from petroleum. The other three are the royalties, the oil and gas property tax, and the state corporate income tax. The royalties, which is not a tax, represents the state ownership share. It's administered by the Department of Natural Resources. Most leases on the North Slope have a 12.5 or 1/8 royalty. And the royalty is based on what we call gross production. Well, that was talked about the other day, and I'll talk about it some more, but that's the gross value of production is the value before you subtract the operating capital cost to produce it. So most royalty rates on the slope, about 12.5%. There's some higher than that, some lower than that. And some leases on the slope are subject to what's called a sliding scale royalty, where the royalty rate actually fluctuates with the price. Some leases have profit shares on top of the fixed royalty rates. And some leases are subject to what's called royalty relief, where certain fields apply to DNR to get their royalty reduced, especially in the opening in the beginning years, to make their project economic. The royalty terms are dictated by the lease, and the lease is determined at the time of the lease sale. DNR puts a lease out there, and that's when they periodically have lease sales. When they buy a lease, the royalty rate is part of that part of the lease determined by DNR, and the lease term is considered a contract. It's not something that's determined by statute. It's a contractual form. The property tax is 20 mils or 2% of assessed oil and gas production property in the state. For oil and gas property that's within a municipality or a borough, like the North Slope Borough or the Fairbanks North Star Borough or a municipality of Valdez, they keep, even though the state administers a property tax, those boroughs or municipalities keep the amount of property tax that's generated within those up to their mill rate. For instance, Fairbanks North Star Borough, there's a 20 mill rate tax, I believe their mill rate is somewhere between 15 and 16 mills, so the Fairbanks would keep that amount, the balance would go to the state, and whatever's not in a borough or municipality, sort of called the unorganized territory, that especially that portion of TAPS that's not in a borough or a municipality, that goes 100% to the state at the 20 mill rate. That's about 45% of the TAPS assessed value goes to the state. And finally, there's a state corporate income tax, and that is 9.4% of apportioned income. And what we mean by apportioned income is the way most states have their corporate income tax. They apportion worldwide income of a corporation to the state, in regard to the relative amount of property, payroll, and sales they have. And so what we have in Alaska is what's sort of called modified apportionment, where we have property production and sales. Those relative amount of property production and sales in the state, that proportion relative to worldwide, that proportion is of their worldwide income is sort of the deemed Alaska income, and that's subject to a 9.4% corporate income tax. And we're going to talk about that in detail in a little later, because there's a there was one event that had the severance tax and the corporate income tax very interrelated. That affects how the corporate income tax still works today. And then in addition to these state taxes, the producers also pay a federal corporate income tax at rate, the nominal rates of 35% of that. And just to show the of these four taxes how they compare relative to each other, for FY 2011, the Department of Revenue is forecasting $5.3 billion in general fund revenues, and that's predicated on a $78 a barrel ANS price. About half of that's the severance tax, about $2.6 billion, royalties $2.2 billion, $104 million for the property tax, and $445 million for the state corporate income tax. Should also mention with the royalties, about 25% of those, 25% of leases that were for acreage that was leased before 1979, 25% of the royalties from those leases goes into the permanent fund. Anything leased after 79, 50% of the royalties go into the permanent fund. And just sort of to set up the vocabulary we're going to be using as we go through this, again, some of this was covered the other day by Department of Revenue. When we say market price, that's the price that ANS is sold at on the West Coast. That's the price you see when you open up the paper in the morning and look at what ANS sold for the prior day. Right now, it's a little over $90 a barrel. The gross value, it's also called the wellhead value, is where you take the market price and subtract the marine shipping costs and the TAPS tariff. Right now, marine shipping's a little over $2. The TAPS tariff's a little over $4. So to get to the market price, to the gross value, subtract about $6. And that's the basis for royalties, and that was the basis for the severance tax up until 2006. Technically, the point where the gross value is the point where the oil is first accurately metered and measured as it leaves the lease. That's a technical definition of the point where the gross value is. Sometimes you hear the words upstream and downstream. Downstream is anything that happens, from the gross value of the point of production towards the market. The upstream are the costs to produce the oil, the operating and capital costs to produce the oil. And that gets us to the net value. When you take the gross value and subtract the operating and capital costs, that gives you the net value. In the current production tax, the term they call it, they use the word production tax value, but sort of the net income. And that includes exploration costs too, subtracted out to get net value. So just as an example, again, if the market price today is about $90, marine shipping is $2 and TAPS tariff $4, it gives you a gross value of $84, and that would be the basis for the royalties. Now, the $84 gross value, that's the gross value at for Prudhoe Bay or at Pump Station 1. For the other fields that have additional pipeline tariffs to get from those fields to Pump Station 1, they have additional pipeline tariffs that are subtracted to get to their gross values. And then to get to the net value, the capital costs, the estimated cost that revenue has for FY 2011, about $12 a barrel for capital, about $11 for operating, and that gives you a net value of about $61 a barrel at a $90 market price. So over the time that the North Slope has been in operation since 1977, there have been four basic, what I call tax regimes. the original economic limit factor, and we'll talk about all these, was in effect from 1977 to 1989. The ELF was modified in 1989, and that was in effect of 2006. The PPT, or Petroleum Production Tax, was in place from 2006 to 2007, and then ACES was in effect from 2007 to the present. Although there are still a couple places in the current law where ELF lives on, we'll talk about that when we get there. This is what the production tax looked like prior to Prudhoe Bay coming on, and this is what Cook Inlet was subject to back then. The production tax was levied on a well-by-well basis, and it was on a higher of, for the first 300 barrels a day, was the higher of 5% of gross value, or 17 cents a barrel, and the cents per barrel got indexed for inflation every year. The next 700 barrels was the higher of 6% of gross, or 20 cents a barrel, and anything over 1,000 barrels per day was the higher of 8% of gross, or 27 cents a barrel, again, subject to inflation. So, people knew well before 1977 that Prudhoe Bay was coming on. They knew it was going to be a big deal. They knew it really made sense to relook at the tax because it was going to be nothing like we had for Cook Inlet. So the Department of Revenue did a study and made recommendations on what they believed an appropriate tax would be with Prudhoe Bay coming on. And what came out of that was what we call the Economic Limit Factor, or ELF. And the theory behind the Economic Limit Factor was in a field's life, at the end of, in sort of, yeah, during the field's life, when it gets to the end of that life, there will be a point where the operating royalty and taxes exceed the revenues. And ordinarily, when that happens, the field would shut down. But the philosophy here is when a field is at this economic limit, the burden of the tax should not cause the field to shut down. So what this ELF was designed to do was to scale down the production tax as production declines over the life of the field, so the tax would become zero at the point where you get to the economic limit. And so the original proposal was that producers should not, the original proposal was given the revenue from the number of barrels that you need to cover your operating costs at the economic limit, that number of barrels should not be subject to tax. They would be tax-free because you had that much revenue to cover your operating costs. So the original proposal, original legislative proposal, was that every month you would figure out how many barrels, given the price of oil, you'd figure out how many barrels you need to cover your operating costs, and those would be tax-free. Well, as you know, often what goes into the legislature and what comes out are quite different. And what came out there was a feeling that that would just be too administratively burdensome to every month have to figure that out. So what the legislature passed was that you would get 300 barrels a day tax-free per well to cover your operating costs, and that's what the statute said. So the way the ELF worked is you get your first 300 barrels per day tax-free. And this was the formula for the ELF. And if we just ignore the exponent for a little bit, we'll just talk about it. What this formula, basically all this formula has is really means is the percentage of your production that's greater than 300 barrels per well per day, and that's the percentage that pays the tax. For instance, if your average daily well production, and this was on a field-wide basis, the ELF was computed. If your average production for the field was 1,000 barrels, you would take 300 over 1,000 is 0.7, and that would be your ELF. Well, 300 over 1,000 is 0.3, and 1 minus 0.3 is 0.7, and so your ELF would be 0.7. So your tax rate would be 0.7 times the nominal tax rate. We'll talk about the nominal tax rate in a minute, but all the ELF was a percentage that was applied to the nominal tax rate to get an effective rate. And this shows the ELF curve. Again, all the ELF is a percentage between 0 and 1, applied to the nominal tax rate, which indicates the percentage of your production over and above 300 barrels per well per day. And as you see, this curve is going down, you know, where the curve hits the bottom axis there at 300 barrels. When you get to 300 barrels, your ELF is zero and your tax is zero. Again, another way to think about ELF was a 300-barrel standard deduction. Now, there was also a gas ELF that was put in, and instead of 300 barrels, each well got 3,000 MCF a day tax-free. Now, why the exponent? This is what the ELF would look like with and without the exponent. Now, the ELF itself is the lower curve here with the exponent. If there hadn't been the reason the exponent was put in, if you look at the ELF without the exponent, as your average well productivity gets lower, that this gap between the two lines widens. It's a higher tax rate. And the reason that was put in was because the Cook Inlet wells had lower oil productivity, and where the North Slope was more to the right with higher productivity. So the exponent was put in to give a tax break to the Cook Inlet well, the older Cook Inlet wells. So this is how the ELF was applied. Again, it was calculated on a field basis based on average well productivity. Again, it's a fraction between 0 and 1. Now, between 1977 and 1981, the way it worked was the ELF was applied to the nominal tax rate, and during this period, the nominal tax rate was 12.25% of gross. So if your ELF was 0.5%, the effective tax rate would be 0.5 times 12.5%, or 6.125%. The nominal tax rate for gas was 10%. Now, between 1981 and 1989, there were some changes made to the ELF was kept the same, but there were some changes made to how it would operate, and plus there were some changes made to the nominal tax rates, and these were made in association with some changes in the corporate income tax. So let's go back up, and again, these changes affect how the corporate income tax works today, so it's probably worth spending a couple minutes to talk about what happened. If we go back to slide 5, where we talked about the corporate income tax, and we said what we have now is what's called modified apportionment. The apportionment factors we use now in the law are property, production, and sales. But that's not how it started out. Again, most states in the United States, I think there may be a few that don't, but nearly every state in the U.S. uses apportionment for their state corporate income tax. And the apportionment factors most states use are, rather than oil production, which most states don't have oil, they use property, payroll, and sales. And when North Slope opened started out, that's what we were using. But that created some problems for the state. The first problem, if you think about it, when the way apportionment works, if what you have going on in the state is relatively more profitable per year, you know, if you're per unit of property or you per unit of sales or you per unit of payroll, if you're relatively more profitable, what happens under apportionment is income gets drawn out of the state. If you're relatively less profitable, more income gets drawn into the state relative to your profitability. That was one, and Prudhoe, with Prudhoe Bay starting up, it was going to make the producers' operations very profitable relative to the rest of the world. So what would happen under normal apportionment is some of that income would be drawn out of the state for calculating the corporate income tax. In addition, the other problem was, since most of the oil was going to be sold in the lower 48, the sales factor was very low. So as a result of these two factors, the income tax was very low. And what the state did to fix this was change the income tax to something called separate accounting. Instead of using apportionment and drawing in worldwide income, it decided just to ring-fence Alaska as itself and measure net income just based on what goes on in the state. And that caused the corporate income tax to go up a lot, several hundred million dollars. Well, the producers sued on that for two reasons. One, given other states used apportionment, it was their judgment that by using separate accounting here, there was double counting of income between what would be taxed here and what would be taxed in other states. In addition, there was the other judgment was that this was somewhat discriminatory because separate accounting only applied to the oil industry in the state. So the producer sued, and the case went to court, and the state was making lots of money off separate accounting. But after, by 1981, the state was accruing a very large liability if it were to lose the case. I mean, the state thought it had a strong case, and actually the state actually won this in the Supreme Court sometime in the late 80s. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court and the state won. But the state didn't know that in 1981, thought it had a strong case, but meanwhile was accruing these large liabilities in case it lost and wanted to hedge its bets. So what it did was modify the corporate income tax to this modified apportionment. They swapped out the payroll factor and brought in this production factor. And since Prudhoe Bay was so prolific, using production as an apportionment factor would draw in a lot more worldwide income. In addition, anecdotally, I was told the producers, in discussions with producers, they indicated that they would not find that legally objectionable to have this modified apportionment. And so if we flip back then to page 15 to get back to the severance tax, what the state did, so since it was going to go from separate accounting as modified apportionment, it was going to take an income hit on the corporate income tax. But to offset that, it made some changes to the severance tax. And these changes were supposed to be about revenue neutral. I think it's calculated, it would bring in a little bit less money, but that was the reason for that was making this change was sort of buying insurance in case of a bad outcome in the Supreme Court. So what the changes that were made in 1981 to the severance tax were as follows. The 12.25% effective rate or nominal rate that had been in place, that was the rate only for the first 5 years of a field. After 5 years, the effective rate for the nominal rate, would be 15%. And then it instituted something called the rounding rule, which said for the first 10 years of a field, if your ELF was greater than 0.7, it would be bumped up to 1.0. And as we'll see in a few minutes, this rounding rule created kind of a time bomb that went off when Prudhoe Bay had its 10-year anniversary, but we'll see that in a few minutes. But those were changes put in 1981.
Excuse me, Mr. Marks, Representative Steve.
Did you want questions as we went along? Did I hear?
I'd be happy with that.
When we're talking about, this is applied to the nominal tax rate of 12.5% on the gross, can you, and what the relative price range was back there, whether it was $20 or something, can you kind of give us a kind of a estimate of what that would be then on the net after capital and operating costs, and what this 12.5% of the gross would kind of equate to when you subtracted those out as far as what that would be on net?
Well, one thing we're going to talk about when we get to the PPT is prior to PPT, since these taxes were based on gross, the state really didn't have a real good idea on what the upstream capital and operating costs were. So we didn't know exactly what net is. I mean, during this era, I could make an educated guess to say if, we're talking about oil prices, in between $15 and $20, those upstream costs were probably in the range of $5 to $10 a barrel. So your nets, your net value would be between $5 and $10 a barrel. So I would, it's probably difficult to do the math in my mind sitting here right now. I'd be happy to spend a little time getting back to you on that.
Sure, I never decide. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So here were the problems with the ELF. The most significant problem was, the ELF was supposed to give you the amount of revenue you needed to cover your operating costs at the economic limit, and 300 barrels is very arbitrary because if the price is $5 a barrel, obviously you need a lot more barrels to cover your operating costs. If the price is $20, you need a lot less. And the 300 barrels was fairly generous in terms of what we believed operating costs were and what prices were. The $300 was pretty generous in covering operating costs. But the other problem with ELF is as you drilled wells, every time you drilled a well, your average well productivity would go down. And every time oil fields, they just naturally start high and decline. And every time, even if you keep the same number of wells, as the field production naturally declines, your well productivity declines. So because of these two factors, your tax rate is constantly going down, regardless of what's going on around you, regardless of what's going on with price. And we'll see that in a few minutes. But the other problem this caused is given what the price of oil was and how much taxes you were paying and given how much it costs to drill a well, you could demonstrate under some circumstances it was advantageous to drill wells to do nothing but drive your tax rate down. It was even if you didn't get any oil, you could drive your tax rate down just by drilling wells. Now, whether producers were doing that, I don't know, but when they evaluated a drilling program, the after-tax drilling program, the ELF effect had to be part of the equation. I mean, just as an anecdote, we talked about the rounding rule, where if your ELF is greater than 0.7, it got rounded up to 1. There were a couple of years where Kaparik's ELF was like 0.69. So it was very advantageous to get to a point where for Kaparik, you just slip. If your ELF was 0.71, it got bumped up to 1. You could just slip it down below 0.7, a big tax savings. And so the problem was, the effective tax rate, what we mean by effective tax rate is the ELF times the nominal rate kept dropping no matter what. So that was the main problem with ELF. And by the late 1980s, there was a convergence of three issues that led to problems. First was the oil price crash of 1986. As I mentioned, during 86, prices were down around $6 a barrel for a while. They hadn't recovered much by 87 or 88. Second, production was declining, and both those affected the state revenues a lot. And because of what I just talked about, the ELF was declining and the tax rate was declining as well. But the other thing that happened was in 1987, the 10-year rounding rule for Prudhoe Bay kicked in. So let's go forward a couple slides here. This is a slide I'm going to be referring to a couple of times. But this shows sort of the history of the economic limit factor, what it was, starting in 1977 when Prudhoe Bay started. And as you follow that curve, Prudhoe Bay had very high well productivity itself, was a little bit below 0.95 at first. Kaparik's, and this is the average for all fields, this curve. Kaparik started up in 1981, so there was a little bit of dip in the average, and then the rounding rule was put in, which brought the ELFs way up. But then you see, if you go to 1987 here, there you see where the 10-year rounding rule expired for Prudhoe Bay, and there was a huge drop in Prudhoe Bay's ELF. And this is sort of the time bomb we talked about. The weighted average ELF for the North Slope dropped from about 0.94 to about 0.78. So that was a big hit. It's worth about $200 million, which is a lot of money now. It was even more money then.
Excuse me, Mr. Mark, could you clarify the 10-year rounding rule?
Sure. The 10-year rounding rule is, again, one of those provisions put in 1981 that said for the first 10 years of a field, if your ELF is greater than 0.7, it gets rounded up to 1. So instead of multiplying the nominal rate by 70%, you multiply it by 100%. And at the time, actually at the time the rounding rule was put in, and a lot of people understood there was going to be this big problem in 1987 when Prudhoe Bay hit 10 years. Now I have a quote here from Governor Hammond at the time. He says, as far as the possible revenue impacts, and he said this in 1981 when the rounding rule was put in, he said, as far as the possible revenue effects in 1988 and beyond, I have full confidence in the ability of the legislature to deal at the time with whatever is required to retain the state's fair share of our oil wealth. So many people understood that that would be coming in 1988, that issue. So if we go back to where we were here.
Briefly, we'll let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Foster, also in the audience, Representative Sadler.
So we had the convergence of these three issues. Governor Cooper took office at the end of 1986. And beginning in 1987, he was very concerned about this issue and was trying, starting in 1987, to try to get the ELF system changed. His economists, many of his economists, including yours truly, encouraged them to try to scrap the ELF and go to a net tax. Hugh Malone, who was Commissioner of Revenue at the time, clearly understood the ELF problem and why a net tax would be preferable. And we're going to talk about net taxes in a little bit. But it was his judgment that if when ELF came to a vote, it was going to be a very close vote. And changing from a different system to a net system would raise enough questions and be confusing to enough people that it was better to keep with the same system as a way to minimizing distortion, minimizing chaos. So the judgment was made to keep with the ELF form. But the idea was to modify the ELF and to bring in a new element in addition to well productivity. And so what was brought in was a new element for field size. Again, field size would be another proxy for profitability as well as daily well productivity. Bigger fields are generally more profitable. And so what the idea was to bring in the field size component in the ELF. Bigger fields would pay more. Smaller fields would be less. This would bring in more revenue and encourage development of small fields as well. And so the way the ELF was modified was to gauge the tax-free treatment depending on field size. And so the fulcrum was about 150,000 barrels a day. The new proposal was if your field was greater than 150,000 barrels per day, you got relatively less tax-free barrels per well per day, relatively less than 300 barrels. And as your field size got smaller than 150,000 barrels a day, you got relatively more tax-free barrels. So this was the equation. It was sort of a double exponent put in that did that. And this applied to oil only. And there was actually a proposal in 1987 that did not pass, a proposal in 1988 that did not pass. And this was the proposal that was put in 1989. This passed the last day of session in 1989. And again, one of these subjective judgments I'll issue right now is I firmly believe it hadn't been for the Exxon Valdez spill, it would not have passed. It passed by one or two votes. The spill clearly moved many people from not voting for this to voting for it. So that's how the ELF got changed in 1989. So with this new factor, field size, instead of having one curve just based on well productivity, you had a whole family of curves based on both your well productivity and your field productivity. So what you see here on the bottom is this graph here. On the left side is ELF. On the bottom is your average well productivity for the field, and each of these lines is what your ELF would be depending on your field size. And again, these ELFs were applied to the nominal rate, the 15% nominal rate, just like the old ELF was. And when this was put into effect, this rate got the ELF back up to where it was before the rounding rule had kicked in back in 1988. And it brought in about $300 million a year more, this change. But one important thing to look at in terms of what this change did is what happens to the small fields. Now, if you look at this graph, you may not realize it, but the very bottom of the graph there is not the boundary of the graph. It's actually the ELF line for a 5,000 barrel per well day field. The red line, the flat red line, 5,000 barrel a day field would have under this equation would have no ELF, pay no tax, no matter what its well productivity is. And even the next line up is a 20,000 barrel a day field, a pretty hefty field size for the North Slope standards. Again, when you get below about 2,000 barrels a day, zero ELF. So after this change, only three fields had a positive ELF on the North Slope: Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and Endicott. The other fields did not have an ELF, paid zero tax, which, as we see, is going to cause some problems down the road. So what were the problems with the second ELF? Again, if we go to this back to this ELF curve, again, looking starting at about 1989 when it passed. Well, what this new ELF did was just reset the thermostat, you know, get it back where it is, but then you have the same problem happens again. The ELF only goes one direction, you know, field size declining, well productivity is declining, the tax rate declines regardless of what's going on around it. So it had basically the same problem. Now, the other issue that came to play after the ELF passed, the new ELF passed in 1989, based on with the new factor of field productivity, was the proliferation of field satellites. In 1989, when the ELF passed, there were five fields operating on the slope. There was Prudhoe, Kuparuk, Milne Point. And actually, Milne Point had been shut down because of low oil prices, but was going to come back up. Lisburn and Endicott, just five fields. The state knew that there were some additional new fields that were going to start up. But after this new ELF passed in 1989, the industry came to the state, and they were concerned that they were going to be starting up what's called satellite development. And what satellite development is there's these main fields in these units. There's the main Prudhoe field, the main Kuparuk field, the main Alpine field. And they were going to develop small fields in association with these main fields, and they were called satellites. And what these satellites were going to do was share drilling facilities and processing facilities. Now, the problem was, under the ELF, from day one, back to 1978, there was a provision in the ELF that said that the department could aggregate fields for determining ELF if they found that the fields were economically interdependent. But under the old ELF, where fields had approximately the same well productivity, aggregating fields was no big deal. It really wouldn't make any effect on taxes because fields basically had the same well productivity. But under the new ELF, where field size came in, when you could aggregate those fields, that was a big deal. And the industry was concerned that if the department exercised this authority to aggregate the fields, it would make the fields uneconomic, either by the high taxes that would ensue, or because they would have to build new facilities to avoid being aggregated. Well, Governor Cooper, you know, immediately said, well, that was certainly not the intent of this. The intent of this was actually encourage small fields. And so the department started drafting regulations where the department would actually could give advance rulings to the producers that it would not aggregate fields under certain conditions. And there were four basic conditions that were in these regs where the department could give an advance ruling not to aggregate. And the conditions were, you know, if the shared facilities reduce cost, and if this advanced drilling would enhance the likelihood of developing the field, and if oil from each field could be separately and, you know, and accurately measured and metered. And the last condition was if the shared facilities was the only factor making the fields interdependent. I mean, the wording in the reg was kind of convoluted. It said if the fields would not be economically independent in the absence of the shared facilities. But if you take out the double negatives there, what it really meant is that if shared facilities, shared drilling processing facilities was the only factor making the fields interdependent. And so the request came in to the department for these advanced rulings. And the department studied them all carefully and granted several of these advanced rulings to several of these satellite development configurations. But by 2000, a request came in, before 2000, a request had come in for Prudhoe Bay for an advanced ruling not to aggregate six new satellites that were under development at the time. And by this time, the department's understanding of what satellite development is was evolving. And one particular aspect that disturbed the department was something that was called backout. And what backout is, you know, these, you have oil fields, and they all have gas that comes in up with it. And as you start out producing a field, you separate the gas and inject it. And the oil that's left in the field absorbs the gas. So as the field matures, more and more gas comes up with the field. And what the processing facilities at these units do is one of the main things they do is separate gas. But you can only separate so much gas depending on you know how big your processing facility is. So for some of these fields, the older fields were coming up, you know, their gas oil ratio was getting very high. And what they did was what they call backout. What they did was since they were constrained by their gas handling capacity, they would actually throttle back the oil from one field that had high amount of gas and bring in oil from another field that had less gas. And what concerned the department as its understanding of satellite development was evolving was that how this backout really interacted with condition number four was only sharing drilling facilities and only sharing processing facilities making these fields independent. This backout created a new dimension to what interdependence meant. And the big problem was that where the statute gave the department the authority to aggregate fields if they were economically independent, the statute never defined what interdependence means, which was a big problem. And so what the Department of Revenue, Department of Law, they mulled over it for several years. And finally it was their conclusion. They came to some sort of conclusion of what they thought interdependence meant in the absence of a statute defining it. And it was their judgment that they thought these satellites, these Prudhoe Bay satellites in Prudhoe Bay, should be aggregated for ELF purposes. They briefed Governor Murkowski on it, and Governor Murkowski concurred. And so in 2005, Governor Murkowski aggregated the six satellites in the main field. Now the fields that had been given the advanced rulings, we didn't touch those because we thought, you know, a good faith agreement had been made and the fields were developed under that, so they weren't touched. But what this aggregation decision did, I mean, what it did was raise the field size for not only we made one big field, so all these little fields that had no ELF was combined with Prudhoe Bay. When you add them all up, Prudhoe Bay itself went up, and to it from about 0.8 to 0.9, and all these little fields, their ELF went from 0 to 0.9. It was worth about $150 million. I believe that decision is still being challenged in court. But that was another issue that came up from this having this field size ELF.
Okay, question from Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Roger, there are a number of people here that weren't here when we, you know, stranded gas and those things when we were talking about satellite fields. And I was just wanting to make sure that either you could explain or whatever that those satellite fields were often just defined as reservoirs at different levels under the same drilling platform. And also, I mean, because, you know, when we think of satellites, most of the time we think of something like in an airfield where it's somewhere away and you take a train to get to it. And these were actually, am I correct, some of these were drilled from the same platforms and wells just at different depths into different vertical reservoirs, and then they were declared as a different field.
Right. Yeah, let me just digress a little bit and just talk about what do we mean by field. Take Kuparuk, for instance. What Department of Natural Resources has is units, which is sort of an administrative concept for how leases are managed. And a unit generally consists of several accumulations. What makes a unit a unit is, again, they share, they're under some sort of common management system. And with something like Kuparuk, for instance, there was the big, you know, Kuparuk field that started up in 1981, and then some other fields were found near it. One was called Tarn. That was one of the larger ones. Tabasco or Meltwater. You may have heard these terms. What these are, technically, these fields are called participating areas, and what they are is where it's a distinct oil accumulation, not in any kind of pressure communication with any other accumulation. So a unit consists of several of these participating areas. What we think of a field is really a participating area. And what these satellites were, you know, you start out with one main participating area or field, and then these other fields, but sharing the same drill pads, sharing the same processing facilities. So there was some integration to how they were operated and managed.
Okay, go ahead.
So to get back to our ELF curve again, now you see the uptick there at the bottom in 2005 when the ELF got aggregated. But again, as you look at, you know, what's happening during the 90s and you know, this decade or the last decade as well, the ELF declined. A lot of people were concerned about this. The term people used was the ELF is broken. And the poster child for the ELF is broken was the Kuparuk field because of its well productivity, which was getting, you know, by 2005 or so, was getting very close to 300 barrels per day. When you get to 300 barrels per day, even under the new ELF, your ELF goes to zero. So Kuparuk, by 2004, 2005 or so, was, again, one of the largest fields in North America, was producing somewhere around 130,000 barrels a day. Itself was darn near zero, or about to become zero. And that's what sort of the poster child that people said the ELF is broken. So how do we get rid of ELF? Well, strangely enough, we got rid of ELF through the Stranded Gas Development Act. For those of you who were not around in 1998, Stranded Gas Development Act was passed in 1998, and what it was set out to do was to try to get a gas line. And the way it tried to get a gas line, it gave the administration the authority to negotiate with the producers a tax system for gas, and once that system was negotiated, it would be put in contract rather than statute, and so there'd be fiscal stability. The tax would be administered by contract rather than statute. So that was what the Stranded Gas Act did. Negotiations started up in 2004 under the Murkowski administration. They lasted about 2 years. And the negotiations stalled for a couple reasons. And one of the reasons is producers wanted fiscal stability for oil. And the reason they wanted fiscal stability for oil was not frivolous. They said, well, if we only get fiscal stability for gas and we cut a deal and down the line you're unhappy with the deal, it's the same producers who are producing gas, producing oil. You can take it out of our hide on oil if you're unhappy with what you get on gas. So they wanted fiscal stability for oil. And that was a stalling point in negotiations for a long time. In addition, the Stranded Gas Act didn't authorize fiscal stability for oil as well. But finally, you know, Governor Murkowski said, okay, we're going to give you fiscal stability for oil. But Governor Murkowski understood, again, he understood very well that ELF was broken. He said, we're going to give you fiscal stability for oil, but we're not going to give you ELF. We're going to have a new oil tax system. And one of his consultants was Dr. Pedro Van Meurs, and he asked Dr. Van Meurs to redesign an oil tax system that he thought would be, you know, protect Alaska's interests and be internationally competitive. And Dr. Van Meurs went off and he designed a proposal, which he called the Petroleum Production Tax. It's a public document. It came out Valentine's Day 2006. That's a public document. And what he did was redesign an oil tax system based on net income rather than gross. And his recommendation was to have a 25% tax rate and a 20% credit rate on capital costs. And we'll talk about those in a few minutes. His proposal did not include any progressivity because he was looking to make the system internationally competitive, and the other jurisdictions that he looked at that Alaska was competing with, they didn't have progressivity as well. In addition, he proposed a system of credits associated with the production tax that we largely have now, and we'll talk about those as well. So the administration, in negotiating an oil tax system within the Stranded Gas Act, came in with this 25% tax rate, 20% credit rate with the producers. That was their opening position in negotiations. And what came out was a 20% tax rate, 20% credit. This represented a sizable tax increase over the ELF. And so what the administration sought to do at that point was to amend the Stranded Gas Act in order to allow this fiscal stability for oil and this oil tax system. And so it went to the legislature with this oil tax system and a proposal to amend the Stranded Gas Act to allow fiscal stability for oil. Well, again, if some of you were around then, the legislature was not real crazy about the gas deal that the administration had struck with the producers. So what the legislature did was simply take the oil tax system that had been proposed, that basically the administration and producers had walked in arm in arm with this proposal that was going to raise taxes. The legislature took that proposal and used that as a starting point for amending the severance tax statute. So that's how we got rid of ELF. Again, we'll talk about ELF lives on in a couple of forms in the current tax, but what that led to was the petroleum profits tax in 2006. And again, this was a tax on net. And a lot of economists, or not a lot, but nearly every economist that I know believes net is a much more efficient way to tax than gross. And here's two basic reasons why. One, if you think about heavy oil, you know, a barrel of light oil on the slope might cost $10 a barrel to produce. A barrel of heavy oil might cost $30. Under a gross system, they would pay the same amount of tax, but under a net system, net system would recognize that difference. The other reason is going to a net system. Again, the administration clearly realized, in 2006, that the oil pipeline was running, you know, somewhere in excess of 60% empty. And one of the reasons a gross system was not in the state's best interest was because under a net system you can deduct your costs. And under a growth system, you can't. So under a net system, you can actually reduce your taxes by investing in Alaska so you can deduct your costs. Under a growth system, you take your profits and invest them somewhere else where you can deduct them. Under a net system, you can invest them here and deduct your costs. So we thought that was the second big reason to go to a net tax. So what the administration came in with is 20%, this 2020 proposal, and the legislature made two main changes to this. First, what passed in the 2006 session was a tax rate of 22.5%. They raised it from 20 to 22.5% of net value. And again, net value is after you deduct all your costs. And the legislature put in a progressivity element. And this progressivity element kicked in when the net value exceeded $40 a barrel. Again, the term in the tax code is production tax value. I just call it net value. So the way the progressivity worked is when the net value exceeded $40, and the $40 was referred to as the trigger, $40 net as the trigger. That's the price. That's the net value where progressivity starts. When the net value exceeds $40, it gets multiplied by 0.25%, and the term is called the slope. That affects how fast the tax rate increases as value goes up. So, for example, LPPT would work under today's oil prices of $90. If the net value, as we said before, costs are about $29, if you take your transportation and operating capital costs, they're about $29 a barrel. So the net value now is about $61 a barrel. Progressivity, you take 61 minus 40 and multiply that by 0.0025. It gives you a progressivity of 7.75%. You add that to the base rate back then of 22.5%, and you get a total tax rate of 27. Well, you know what? I have a typo here.
Yeah.
That should be... sorry about that. You take the 22.5, add the 7.75, and you would get a 30%. Let's see.
Just 7.75,
not 27.
We're at 21 times
0.25. Oh. I don't know how to use that. So you take the 22.5, add the 7.5, and get a 30% total tax rate.
Yeah, that's right. You get the 7.5.
You'll take a brief out of you?
No.
Please, Mentor.
Okay, here's where the correction needs to be made. The progressivity, if you take 61 minus 40 and multiply it by 0.0025, you get 5.25%.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Apologize for that. Then if you take the 22.5 and add the 5.25, so that next to last line is correct, you get 27.75%, and that's your tax rate. And that's multiplied by the $61 net value to give you $16.93 a barrel. Now the way, along with that, the progressivity peaked at 25%. Now when the progressivity got to 25%, it would stop. And that would be added again to the 22.5% rate. Along with this, there was another provision for the capital costs. Right before the PPT was being debated in the legislature was the same time that there was a big corrosion spill on the North Slope, which concerned people that we shouldn't allow deductions for maintenance that should have happened, that those deductions. And so what came as a result of that, 30 cents a barrel was subtracted from capital costs is what you could deduct as a sort of a maintenance provision. Again, there were credits that came along with that. And again, since the credits that were in PPT didn't change that much with ACES. I think it'd be better to talk about the credits when we get to ACES to talk about just how the current tax system works. There was also a floor put in. A floor was the higher of 4% of gross or what the PPT produced as well. So this is a graph showing what the severance tax rate was after, under PPT. Again, this shows, you know, depending on your net value at the bottom. Again, to get the market price, you add about $29 a barrel. So what you see here is, you know, at $40, you see where the trigger is. You see the progressivity kicking in, and the slope there is that 0.25% is the angle, you know, represents the rise in the tax rate as value goes up. Cook Inlet, in terms of one, you know, where ELF lives on, it was decided that Cook Inlet should stay under ELF, even under PPT, and again, that's in current law as well. And what they did was whatever your ELF was at the time of PPT went into effect, which was April 2006, whatever your Cook Inlet ELF was, that stayed in place. So for oil, Cook Inlet oil, zero ELF, zero tax. Gas, basically, gas pays your Cook Inlet gas pays 17 cents an MCF in production tax, because that's what the ELF provision was at the time. And those provisions under the current law stay in place until 2022. And this just shows the, instead of the tax rate, the tax per barrel under PPT. Well, there were two main problems with PPT. You know, the one, when PPT was under debate and the department was trying to do the fiscal, you know, trying to do the fiscal note for PPT, as I mentioned before, since we had been under a gross tax for all that time, the department didn't have a really clear idea what the costs would be. And these costs under PPT would be deductible. So the department had to estimate what those costs would be in the absence of perfect information. In addition, even if the department had information, had no perfect information, at the time at the first year the PPT was in effect, which was 2007, there was incredible cost inflation in the world in the petroleum sector. So costs went up a lot. As a result of that, the revenues that came in under PPT were a lot less than what people were expecting. People were expecting about, at prices at the time, about $1.1 billion more in production tax. Only about $0.3 billion more came in, so there was about $800 million difference there. That concerned people. The other issue that happened, and I call it here VECO taint, and everyone knows what I mean, at you know, what happened after the session in 2006, you know, there was some evidence that some votes for PPT may have been influenced by some relationships with VECO that were not appropriate. So Governor Palin came in the end of 2006 and believed that, you know, there was because of this tainting issue, there was sort of a lack of confidence in what had happened during the 2006 session. And what she wanted to do was sort of replay history and have another session to look at oil taxes free of the taint. So what the Palin administration, they proposed their own new production tax, and they called it ACES, Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share. And their proposal was to increase the tax rate to 25%, which would be a tax increase, drop the trigger to $30, which would mean progressivity would start at a lower amount, which would increase taxes, but drop the slope from 0.25% to 0.2%. So that was their proposal going into the 2007 session that ACES was under debate.
Excuse me, Mr. Morris. Thank you. Roger, there was a presentation by ex-commissioner, Revenue Commissioner Galvin at Commonwealth North recently discussing the provisions. And the other factor that was put into this was that their information had come out that some of the new wells, drilled by BP up there, were paid off in 90 days. Do you recall that being part of the the impetus of this problem with PVT as well?
I do not.
Okay.
But as I said, as I said, my opening caveats, different people have different recollections, and they could be absolutely valid. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So what happened, ACE, in terms of structure, ACEs was very, very similar to PPT. And what came out was, in terms of what the administration proposed, there was one basic change to what the administration proposed in 2007 that came out. The base rate was increased to 25%. The trigger was dropped to $30, but instead of the slope being reduced from 0.25 to 0.2, the slope was actually increased to 0.4. So that was the major change that came out of the 2007 session. And so it operated, exactly like the PPT. Again, if we have a $90 price and $61 a barrel, as hopefully I did the arithmetic right here, the progressivity under ACEs would be $61 minus 30 times 0.004, which would be 12.4% progressivity, add to the 25% base rate, which gives you a 37.4% tax rate. And then just going back, that 37.4 for ACEs compared to 27.5 under PPT. The other provision, the way progressivity works under ACEs in the current law, again, this is the current law. When your progressivity gets up to 50%, which is at $92.50 net, the slope drops to 0.1%. So it, at that point, it starts increasing at a very slow rate. There were some changes to the credits made. We'll talk about those in a few minutes. But this is basically the current tax now. And this shows compares the ACEs and PPT severance tax rates. Again, you see under ACEs, the trigger, it starts out at $30, where with PPT it was $40. ACEs has a steeper slope. And there you see those bends at the curve at the end where, under the top curve ACEs, that's where it hits a net of $92.50 and the slope drops from 0.4 to 0.1%. And PPT, the bottom curve, it peaks at 50% and then just gets flat. And this shows the tax per barrel. ACEs brought in 2008, when oil prices averaged about $100 a barrel, ACEs brought in about $2 billion more than PPT would have brought in. The ELF provisions for Cook Inlet, they stayed in ACEs. In addition, a new provision was put in that any gas that's used in state for fuel, meaning either space heat or power production, any in-state use of gas is also subject to that, what the Cook Inlet ELF was in April of 2006, 17 cents per MCF. Again, that provision grandfathers out in 2022. I also had a request to look at ELF along with these, and what this curve shows is the bottom line is ANS market price. What happens with PPT, ACEs, and ELF? What the severance tax would be as a percent of net? And, of course, PPT and ACEs were already a percent of net, but had to convert ELF, which was percent of gross, to a percent of net based on a $29 cost. And as you see, on a percent of gross, the ELF was just flat. Department of Revenue figures, if ELF were still in effect now, the weighted average ELF would be about 0.37. And if you multiply that times a 15% tax rate, you get about a 5.5% effective rate. That's what ELF would be, that's what the ELF would be right now, about 5.5% of gross flat. If you put that on a net basis, since as prices go up, net is a higher percent of gross. So when you put something on a just a flat when you put something that's just a flat percent of gross on a net basis, you see it it's a decreasing percent of net. That's why that ELF curve is sloping down. And that's how royalties work now. Royalties, which are 12% of gross, as prices get higher, it's a smaller percent of net. So that shows, this shows at current cost at 29%, at $29 a barrel cost. And this just shows those graphs at $39 cost, what they would look like. Now, I started these curves as $50 a barrel market price because what happens at lower prices gets pretty weird. But then I had a request to show, we'll show these lower prices anyway. So this is what happens at lower prices. And what you see going on with ELF here is it follows. Now ELF is the bottom is ANS market price going down to $0 a barrel. Again, the ELF is based on gross. And there's a $6 and gross is the difference between market price and your transportation costs. You're about $6. So until oil prices get about $6, you have no gross value, so ELF is zero. But starting at $6, what happens is you start having a positive ELF. But since your cost, since we calculate this as a percent of net, until you start having positive net value up at $29 a barrel, you have a positive ELF since it's based on gross, but it's a percent of a negative number since net's negative until you get to a $29 market price. So that's why this ELF curve is negative until you get to $29 a barrel where you have a positive net value, and then it shoots up because you have a positive value divided by a positive value. So,
Representative,
thank you. I'm just trying to figure this out. This below, we're showing it as a percentage of net, but that isn't the way the tax worked. The tax worked on a percent of gross.
Right.
So if we were actually looking at the tax paid would be constantly higher at these lower numbers, not as a percent of gross, but actually of talking about how much was paid. If you're paying
right.
so much per barrel, if it costs you $6 a barrel, if it costs you $5 to produce it, you're having to take an extra dollar out of profit somewhere to pay that. But, I mean, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, if we express this as actual money paid, it would be positive. But wasn't a lot of time to kind of put this together, but we just did it as a percent of net. But if there's any other way you'd like to see this, just contact Representative Hawker's office, and we can do what you want with
sure.
that. Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, yeah, I appreciate you doing this because we're trying to understand both on the downside on, you know, how these taxes work when there isn't a large amount of profit as well as when there is a large amount of profit. So I think that however we can put that together based on actual, you know, we can take 100,000 barrels or whatever mm-hmm. and just put in some dollars would be helpful, I think, for us to see the relationship of how these taxes would actually work in real world instead of just as a percent of profit.
Okay.
Thank you.
And another dimension again that I didn't have time to model here because of time is both ELF and PPT and ACES have a higher of provision. It's higher of four. PPT and ACES are higher 4% of gross, or the PPT calculation did not have time to model the crossover point here, so that's missing. And actually under ELF there was also a minimum of 80 cents a barrel tax as well, did not have time to model that. So but these are, I mean, again, when you get the $50 a barrel more, and that's sort of forward looking, hopefully we're not going to go below $50 a barrel. These things are fairly accurate, and this shows the same information with $39 costs. And what this shows too is sort of interesting. If you look at the difference between gross and net, where you know, gross, if you look at where your net tack, where your net value, you know, where that elf spikes up, you know, at just over $39 a barrel, where you have a tax based on gross, it's a very, very high percentage of net, which is, again, why taxes based on gross, most economists believe they're just not efficient. So this brings us to the credits, and department went over these last, you know, the other day. I'll go over them briefly, but these were, many of these credits came directly out of Dr. Van Muir's recommendations and exist to this day. There were just a few changes made between PPT and ACES, so I'll just, you'll hit the highlights. You know, there's a 20% credit on capital costs. For areas outside the North Slope, there's a 40% well lease expenditure credit, and those are credits that are directly related to drilling wells. That 40%, that provision was put in last year. Under HB 110, the governor's bill, there is a proposal to expand that 40% credit to include the North Slope. There's exploration credits ranging from 20 to 40%, depending on where your bottom hole location of your exploration well is, and depending on whether you're inside an existing unit or outside an existing unit, or how far from an existing unit you are. There's a small company credit of $12 million that was put in if you produce less than 50,000 barrels a day and have enough offsetting income. There's a $12 million credit you can use. There are some provisions put in last year, very aggressive credits for the first three parties that explore the Cook Inlet pre-tertiary zone with a jackup rig. The first entity gets 100%, second 90%, third 80%. Up to $25 million, $22.5 million, or $20 million. If they find, you know, if they have commercial production as a result of this exploration, they have to repay 50% of the credit. By the way, no double dipping on these credits. If you have an expenditure that you're claiming a credit under one of these, you can't, you know, use that same expenditure for a second credit as well. And then there's loss if you have a net operating loss. In other words, you can't use all your deductions. You can convert your unused deductions at 25% to a credit. There's a 4 of 0 of the tax. So in case you can't monetize your credits because you're down to a zero tax, if you don't have sufficient offsetting income, you can either keep your credit until you do have sufficient offsetting income. You can sell your credits to other taxpayers, you will always get less than 100%, less than 100% on the dollar for selling it to someone else. And if you produce less than 50,000 barrels a day, provision that was put in ACES, the state will buy your credit from you.
Excuse me, Representative Gardner, you have a question?
Yes, thank you very much. We had another presentation, I believe it was the last time we met, from the Department of Revenue. Is that correct? And they talked about the small company credit in the same area. They talked about a $6 million production, a credit for production outside of North Slope and Cook Inlet.
Right.
And I believe they said that these were cumulative. Is that an exception from the other credit rule?
That's correct, Representative Garner, through the chair. There is an additional $6 million credit. It's not a small company credit. It's anyone can get this. This is if you produce either non-North Slope, non-Cook Inlet. That expires in 2016. I would doubt that credit is ever used. That anything's going to happen between now and 2016 in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
I may be wrong, but what those these credits, the $12 million or $6 million, are use or lose credits. If you don't have offsetting income in the year you earn the credit, you can't carry it over or sell it.
Thank you.
And then to close out the severance tax history, this is just the time series and how much severance tax we've collected over the whole state between 1977 and FY 2010. A total of $40 billion. So that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to take any additional questions if there are any.
Yeah, I'd like to take a brief at ease, give everybody a chance for a sort of seventh inning stretch, and be about 2 minutes, and then we'll get back and deal with questions.
All right, bring us back into session. Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
I did, but I can't remember what it was.
Okay.
It comes to me.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. I believe a question had been asked earlier about the $12 million, and that seemed to be a odd figure, and I was wondering if Mr. Marks should just go ahead and recap of where the $12 million figure came from, how it was arrived at.
Yeah, Representative Seaton, through the chair, this is actually the second area where ELF lives on, this credit, given its origin. When Dr. Van Meurs was designing the PPT, he understood that there were some projects under development, small fields, that would have had a zero ELF, and these developments were occurring. You know, people start out developing these fields assuming they would be under ELF and have a zero tax. This provision was put in so that small development would continue to have a zero ELF, that these people would still pay zero tax, and it would also create an incentive for small fields for production and small companies to have that $12 million credit in there. And the way the $12 million was arrived at, he was looking at some of these small fields that were being developed, and at the current prices at the time, which I think were about $45 a barrel, he just sort of backed into the amount of credit you would need, given how much oil these fields would produce at $45, what your tax would be under PPT to bring it down to zero, and that's where the $12 million was put in. And frankly, the other reason this $12 million credit was put in was a way to get political support for the PPT from small companies during 2006 session. That's sort of the origin of it.
And Mr. Chairman, just a little more expansion on that. It was looked at as $60 million deduction was the way this was originally formulated. So in the first $60 million of production from a field, you wouldn't have a tax, and later that got converted at 20% to just a $12 million tax credit because it was easier to implement.
That's exactly right, Representative Seaton.
Okay, Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess following on that point is, I understand that the $12 million, the $6 million, during the buildup to pass that legislation, it was to get buy-in for those. I completely understand that. Now, is it important to maintain those, the 12 and the 6, in any adjustments to ACES? Or increase those amounts?
Is it important? It probably, you know, I would say it probably is for small fields. I mean, given the geology, and again, this is not really small fields, it's small companies. And given the costs on the North Slope, my understanding is, and if you're getting into new areas, you're getting into really high costs. And just to create additional incentives for some of these small companies to come in. In addition, I mean, a lot of where discoveries occur, you know, not only in around the world, the biggest risk takers are small companies. And so as a way to get small companies in here to get you know, bigger risk taking, it probably is a good feature to retain. As a way to just encourage, you know, a wider number of views as to what is geologically attractive.
Mr. Chairman, a clarification. Severance taxes. I understand what a severance tax is, but if we were to figure out how to value add any resource, oil is what we're talking about today. Would that have a profound effect on our on our, on the taxes?
Representative Herron, through the chair, I don't understand the question.
Well, severance tax, isn't it a no-value resource leaving the state that that is sold to another state or other states? Isn't that what severance tax is, essentially?
Well, it's a tax on severing, you know, severing the non-renewable resource from the
but
state.
But the resource is not value-added, Mr. Chairman?
What do you mean by value-added?
Say, for example, Mr. Chairman, that somewhere down the line before it's refined somewhere in the state, and it leaves the state under a refined product, would the severance tax be significantly different? Would the tax on that oil be significantly different if we value-added the resource? Because we did it in-state, Mr. Chairman.
Well, the value for something like a refinery, I mean, the oil that's what you're valuing is what gives value to the oil is its market price. And I mean, the value that comes out of the ground is its market price less its cost, and that's the tax base. When you have value added, you actually have costs added, and I mean, it's obviously a little bit of profit on that, but the basic feedstock that goes into a refinery basically reflects the value of the oil, which is being taxed, which is what, you know, how the severance tax is based. So as a feedstock, I mean, as a feedstock to a refinery, it's the same thing. It's the value of the oil.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the comment to the co-chairs is, I guess that's what's so frustrating is it's we get more value, quote, value out of a log in the round leaving the state rather than building lumber here and trying to export that finished lumber. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly something to look at in the production tax, what kind of credits we can give for in-state use of that gas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. You said on the PPT tax that the progressivity kicked in at $40 on net, profit on the barrel. Did that tax apply to the full profit, or did it just apply to the profits over $40?
If we... You know, again, your progressivity, and this is the one where we had the messed up arithmetic, but your total tax rate with progressivity and the base rate was 27.75. That 27.75, and this is actually important to understand why there's been discussion of why there's high marginal tax rate under ACEs. What causes all this? And we actually let's do it with ACEs because that's the current tax. But under ACEs, you know, progressivity starts when you go above $30, and you have that 12.25% added to the 25 for a 37.4. But the 37.4 doesn't apply to the 31st dollar. It goes back to it applies to the entire net value. It applies to every single dollar of value. And that's sort of the genesis of the argument that some people have talked about ACEs having high marginal tax rates, because it goes back to dollar number one and pulls up the value every time the value goes up.
If I can follow up. So did it do that under PPT or not?
It did it exactly under PPT.
It did it. Okay. Yeah. All right. And then just a couple more questions. You said that Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, and Endicott were the only fields that paid under the ELF factor.
After it passed in 1989. Yep. Affirm.
Okay. And then you also used the term that in the Kuparuk field was the poster child for a broken ELF. Could you explain that again?
Sure. By, you know, the ELF was going down, mm-hmm. and at Kaparik by the early part of last decade, around between 2000 and 2005 or so, was getting to the point where even though it was producing about 130,000 barrels a day, and, you know, at prices, very healthy prices, $40 to $50 at the time, one of the largest fields in North America, because of the ELF calculation, it was paying just about zero tax. So that's what I mean by the poster child of a broken ELF, that you have what appeared to be a very, very healthy, economically healthy field paying no tax.
All right, and then just one final question. The tax regime has changed four times in the last 25 years or so. Is that considered erratic or unusual as tax regimes go in the world, oil province regimes?
When people talk about fiscal stability and what sort of international standards are, I think a lot of oil companies generally expect that a tax will change roughly every 10 years. That's about, when it happens. So.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Marks, one of the things we're trying to do in this committee is essentially put more oil in the pipe. We're not, in our immediate deliberations, we're not looking at necessarily how much money the state's making, how much profit the oil companies are making. But our objective is to take a look at the bill that's before us, the governor's bill, and how do we structure it the best way to do just that, put more oil in the pipe. Now, we've got all kinds of different development that could happen on the North Slope. You've got new fields, adjacent to the areas that are currently unitized. You've got development within each of those unitized areas, different kinds of oil, heavy oil, viscous oil. They're talking about drilling for oil within the source rock around Prudhoe Bay. Individual fault blocks using directional drilling to tap into. In your opinion, what is the best way we can construct this bill or adjust this bill before us to encourage companies to put more oil in the pipe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess getting back to that, what we were talking about before, about the way the progressivity structure works, when your price goes up a dollar, you draw the tax rate up for every single dollar below that. And what you end up with, we have the concept of marginal tax rate. When the marginal tax rate means when the price of oil goes up a dollar, what percentage of that dollar goes to government? The way progressivity is an absolutely fine concept. I mean, it's a basic, straightforward philosophy that at lower income you can afford to pay less and you have a lower rate. And higher income, you can afford to pay more and have a higher rate. So progressivity makes perfect sense. It is my judgment that the progressivity structure within ACES is seriously dysfunctional. And it's seriously dysfunctional because the way it works is when your value goes up, when you go from $89 to $90, not only does the tax rate on the 90th dollar goes up, the tax rate on $1, $2, $3, you draw up the tax rate on all those previous dollars of value as well. And that's what leads to what we call these high marginal tax rates. They can exceed 90% at high prices. And why is that a problem? When companies look at developing a prospect, they have a lot of inputs, and one of the inputs is what do they expect price to be, and as we all know, prices are very volatile and very hard to forecast. So what they look at is what was going to happen under a range of prices, and they'll put a distribution of prices in that could, and there, and you can find non-frivolous oil price forecasts now that go up to $200 a barrel by 2020.
Most people expect that more things can happen to make prices go up in the future than down. And so when companies look at what their price forecasts are and how things operate, you know, how things work under a variety of prices, what happens on the high side at high prices can be very important to their outcome, because if high prices materialize, they can make a lot of money. And what ACES does with these high marginal tax rate, it caps upside potential, because when your marginal tax rate get higher, 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 you get to a point, as price goes up, you're not making very much money anymore. And if you compare those marginal tax rates between Alaska and the rest of the world, the other international jurisdictions where Alaska competes, Alaska at high prices, as from what I can tell, and I've looked at this quite a bit, the highest marginal tax rates in the world, which I believe makes us seriously uncompetitive. Now, is there evidence of this? You know, I think there is. I mean, the Department of Revenue put some data out there the other day. You know, we had 3 exploration wells drilled last year. That was the smallest number of exploration wells since 1988, when prices were $8 a barrel. Now, is that a problem? I think it is. If you go back and look at what, you know, either the Department of Revenue or the Department of Natural Resources were forecasting, what's production going to be between 2010 and 2020? Look at it before, and actually, I believe PPT is as the PPT was as dysfunctional on the upside because of the same progressivity structure as well. And if you look at what they were forecasting before PPT and what they're forecasting now over, say, the 2010-2020 horizon, huge reductions, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of barrels back in 2006 that they thought were going to be produced between 2010 and 2020. And what they say is now. And these are basically from the same field. It's not like, you know, one field we thought this field was going to come in, but it's not. It's from these core fields, the Prudhoes, Kuparix, Alpines. If you look at the forecasts, you know, 80-90% of all the oil is going to come from those fields. There's a lot of oil to be developed from them. And so, you know, is ACES or PPT the cause of that? You know, it may not be 100% of the cause, but I believe it's a major contributing factor. Now, one way to fix this is fix the progressivity structure. And the way in either HB 17 or HB 110, this bracketing, where, you know, under ACES or PPT, where you draw the tax rate up for every single dollar as prices goes up, what bracketing does, you only pay incremental tax on incremental value, which lowers the marginal tax rates. And that's how progressivity universally works around the world. I've spent a lot of time on this. I cannot encounter any other progressivity structure anywhere, be it oil or non-oil, anywhere on Earth that works the way it worked under PPT or ACES. So my judgment would be to go to a bracketed tax structure and to use international competitiveness with you know, other jurisdictions that Alaska competes with to get comparable, you know, marginal tax rates, average tax rates. I think the credit system you have in the current law is very strong, very good for encouraging development. I would not focus on the credits. The fact that you can have credits coupled with deducting these costs are significant incentives for developing. But what's the high tax rates are dwarfing anything the credits do. So it'll be my judgment that to put more barrels in the line to fix the progressivity structure you have now.
Okay. In addition to the bracketing structure, you said that essentially the credit structure was the same. But I guess the way the current system is, the capital credits are sort of or the capital costs are reported as one item, and that includes operations and maintenance as well as exploration. Is there any advantage to having companies report those exploration and operations and maintenance costs separately, and then adjusting the credit structure to apply to either side of that?
To favor one or the other, favor more exploration and development versus operations and maintenance?
Well, if it, you know, I don't know. I mean, if it were possible to separate out capital costs that are going towards producing more barrels, it's all production. Even when you're maintaining things, it's in a way it's producing, and you want to encourage. I mean, you certainly want to encourage the producers to maintain their fields, and the credits do that as well. I think the credit structure now is strong, and I think I would really focus on the progressivity structure rather than the credits.
Okay. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was going to be how do we compare in terms of other states and nations, and you said universally we're different from all of those. And I just wanted to maybe help in making the distinction or help folks to understand where the current system of ACEs and PPT before stood, and that is to say that every individual's taxes are based on incremental taxation for the incremental value. And so, if I were to go from the 20% tax bracket to 25, I pay that on the next past the 40,000, from 40 to 50,000 I make as an individual, and that doesn't go retroactive to the first dollar that I make, and that's the point that you're trying to
make. That's exactly. Right? I mean, what's been proposed in HB 17 and HB 110 mirrors it. What's in your IRS tax booklet I guess it didn't come in the mail this year, but up to this year came in the mail, so.
I guess what we're saying is we shouldn't encourage the IRS to embrace progressivity.
Well, they have progressivity. They bracket it.
They bracketed it. That's true.
Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Talking about the history and these instead of so much the other, if we look at slide 31, just for instance, so we're looking at a price of $90 a barrel and compare that to $125 a barrel.
It's $50.
What does an oil company invest or do to change that price from 90 to 125?
We're looking at the market price. You mean the market price?
Yeah, the $90 where the progressivity, where our tax rate is at 36 or so, and 125 where it's 50.
Mm-hmm.
So what effort does the oil company expend, or what do they do to make that change?
Well, what this shows is if your costs are $29 a barrel and the market price are what they are, this is your tax rate. I guess I don't understand.
Well, the question is, we've got a system in which we are charging for resources that are coming out of, this is a severance tax, that are being taken out of the state, non-renewable resource. And I'm wondering what the effort is that the oil company undergoes to have that change from 90, from the 36% where we charge it, $90 a barrel, to $125 a barrel. I mean, to get there, are we saying that the oil company is having an effort to constrain supply? I mean, are they buying bullets for use in Iran or something? Or what is the oil company doing to that they should keep basically most all of that profit difference between 90 and 125 dollars instead of having progressivity or having significant progressivity?
Well,
you know, even under ACES, I think, you know, the producers are making a lot of money now, even under ACES. The question is, how much more can they make somewhere else? You know, at the corporate level, these corporations have a finite amount of capital, and you know, we're in the age of globalization. The Iron Curtain fell 20 years ago. We've had the internet, you know, for more than 10 years. This capital is very fluid. This capital, an oil company can put capital lots of places. ConocoPhillips, for instance, has presence in more than 30 countries around the world. They can put the money here. They have this much money. They can put it here. They can put it there. Where are you going to get the most for the money? And that's why I believe looking at international competitiveness is key. And I actually believe as well in looking at these looking at these production forecasts and how they've dropped between 2006 and now. I truly you would think as prices go up, you would produce more oil. I truly believe it's very possible that because of ACES, when the price goes up, the schism between our tax and international competitive tax rate widens. So at the higher prices are, the more capital gets diverted from Alaska to elsewhere. And so at higher prices, we get less oil.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
So my understanding of your answer is they don't do anything to change the price from 90 to 120.
They don't.
Okay, they don't do anything there. And the significance is that we can expect continuation of removing their investment from oil in Alaska to gas, which keeps getting told to all of us that it's very unprofitable, and that's why, for instance, ConocoPhillips has a much higher percentage of profit coming from Alaska investments than they do their international investments, because that's gas and it's a poor investment, and that they're going to take their capital from here and put it in those gas projects because of the marginal tax rate here, even though their percentage increase in profits here is much larger than it is internationally. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, ConocoPhillips is an oil and gas company and with interests all around the world. And, you know, worldwide, they produce about 50% oil and 50% gas. And what I'm suggesting is it's very possible. I mean, what oil, they can invest in oil here and oil somewhere else. I mean, they also invest in gas, but they have lots and lots of oil in their portfolio, oil opportunities in their portfolio. And they can earn this much here on the oil or this much on the oil somewhere else. And that's why I believe Alaskans should be very concerned about how we compete. I think, you know, the idea of fair share, people have, you know, that's a complicated concept. You know, and I'm putting on my economist hat, which is, you know, I guess not, that's not the way exclusively to look at it, but just wearing my economist hat, you know, in many ways, what fair value is for oil is no different than what a fair price, you know, for a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk is. You have many people competing, you know, many people competing to sell something. You have, you know, other people on the other side of the equation that want to get the best deal. And so what's fair is what you can get in a competitive environment. And that's how I would see fair share. Now, people can see it differently, and that, I mean, that's absolutely, you know, other valid ways to see it. But putting on my economist hat, again, fair, you know, fair is what you can get in a competitive environment. And you know, quite bluntly, if you think you're entitled to more than that, you may end up in a not very good place. Again, my opinion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Herron, we've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marks, it's is I asked the commissioner, Brian Butcher, related to your responses. You know, the current law stair steps up to a certain value, then progressively takes off, and then the proposed legislation stair steps up to a certain value, then goes flat. My question to Commissioner Butcher is once we get up there around $100, and this is for emerging fields, but essentially the taxes, and what I understood you say, shouldn't we consider stair-stepping back down so there is more impetus for and more incentive for the oil companies to plow that money back into Alaska? I don't know if I support it being flat when it gets up to around $100. I think that it should stair-step down to encourage it, oil production development in our state.
At high prices, stair-step down? Or
yeah,
uh-huh.
Stair-step down
uh-huh.
when it gets to a certain point. Because we need more money back in the state for the chairman's wishes to fill the pipeline with oil.
Well, that's an interesting proposal. The main thing is you want to protect the state's interest too. And again, looking at the international environment, you don't need to do that. You don't need to stair step down at high prices to be competitive. You can, you know, under these bills, I think at the marginal tax rates peak at about 75%, which means the producers, walk away with 25% of incremental value. You know, at high prices, that seems to be the lay of the land. Now, having said that, I mean, you could pass the perfect tax this year, but you need to continually monitor the international environment to stay competitive. That's what life in the age of globalization is.
Okay, we're pretty much out of time. So Mr. Marks will be available, assume most of the rest of the day, and at least feel available in the state here the next week and a half. He'll be out of pocket after next week for a short time. If you guys have any questions, please feel free to address them to Mr. Marks. Thanks very much for your presentation. You gave us a great education. A couple things for the members of the committee. Next Wednesday and Friday, as far as our schedule, Representative Olson has been kind enough to deed us an hour, a 3 to 4 hour block, which would normally be his committee meeting in this room. We need to know if you guys are going to be available to sit in or whether you have appointments that you can't reschedule, and that will hopefully give us time, as much time as possible, to hear from as many producers, explorers, and subcontractors as possible. So if you could get that information to us or to the aides, that'd be great. Other than that,
what time would that be?
We just continue. We'd go
from
3 to 4. 3 to 4.
3 to 4.
Right. And with that, we'll go ahead and gavel out at 3:03 p.m.